Good morning and welcome, everyone. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board on April 22nd, 2008. We welcome those of you who have joined us today, both in person and listening to the webcast of this meeting. Today, the board will consider a recommendation to adopt a new ethics and independence rule, communication with audit committees concerning independence, that would supersede the board's interim independence requirement, independent standards board standard number one. In addition, the board will consider a recommendation to adopt an amendment to rule 3523, tax services for persons in financial reporting oversight roles, and to further adjust the implementation schedule for that rule as it applies to tax services provided during the audit period. Before we proceed with the agenda, I will note for the record that all board members are present. The first and only order of business before the board today is a staff recommendation that the board adopt a new rule on auditors' communication with audit committees concerning independence and an amendment to Rule 3523. I'll now turn to our chief auditor for the staff's recommendation. Tom.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Bella Rivson and I are pleased to be here to recommend that you adopt a new ethics and independence rule, Rule 3526, communication with audit committees concerning independence. That would supersede a similar independence rule adopted by the board on an interim basis, and an amendment to the board's Rule 3523, tax services for persons in financial reporting oversight roles. As you noted, we also are recommending an amendment to the interim independence rules and to further adjust the implementation schedule for a portion of Rule 3523 to facilitate the adoption of the matters before you this morning. To set the stage, I think it will be helpful to provide a brief history on how we arrived here this morning. In 2005, the board adopted Rule 3523, which stated that, subject to certain exceptions, a registered public accounting firm is not independent of its audit client if the firm, or any affiliate of the firm, provides any tax services to certain persons in a financial reporting oversight role or their immediate family members either during the audit period, that is, the period covered by any financial statements that are to be audited or reviewed by that registered firm, or during the professional engagement period, that is, the period of the engagement to audit or review the audit client's financial statements, or to prepare a report filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. As the board stated when adopting Rule 3523, the provision of tax services by the auditor to the senior management responsible for the audit client's financial reporting creates an unacceptable appearance of the auditor and such senior management as having a mutual interest. As the implementation date of Rule 3523 drew near, we considered a specific consequence of the new rule on a company's choice of auditor when the company is considering a change in auditors. When a registered accounting firm accepts a new audit client, the audit period may cover a period of time before the commencement of the professional engagement period. In such circumstances, the rule effectively prevents a firm from accepting a new audit client when the firm, or an affiliate of the firm, provided tax services to certain company executives during the period covered by any financial statements to be audited or reviewed, even if those services were provided only prior to the time at which the firm is being appointed as the company's auditor. In April of 2007, the board, through the issuance of a concept release, sought additional information about the possible effects on a firm's independence of providing tax services to a person covered by Rule 3523 during the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period, and other practical consequences of applying the restrictions imposed by Rule 3523 to that portion of the audit period. After careful consideration of the comments we received on the concept release, we came to believe that it is not necessary to restrict the provision of tax services to persons covered by Rule 3523 during the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period in order to preserve auditor independence. The board noted That Rule 3523 relates to services provided to individuals at the audit client rather than to the audit client that issues the financial statement subject to audit. The board also observed that registered firms would remain responsible for considering the relevant facts and circumstances of a specific tax engagement and determining whether their independence is impaired under the SEC's general standard of independence. Additionally, the board noted that this approach would allow for a more tailored application of the independence requirements to this area that would prohibit only those services that pose a risk while allowing those that do not and avoid any unnecessary impediments to changing auditors. The audit committee also plays an important role in ensuring that the company's auditor is independent. Several commenters to the concept release encouraged the board to consider requiring additional communication between the auditor and the issuer's audit committee about matters that might bear on the auditor's independence if the board decided to amend Rule 3523. They also pointed out that one of the board's interim independence requirements, Independent Standards Board Standard Number 1, Independence Discussions with Audit Committees, also referred to as ISB Number 1, that would facilitate that important communication. Additionally, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, along with the SEC's related implementation rules, enhanced the required communication between the audit committee and the auditor by requiring the issuer's audit committee to pre-approve audit and non-audit services provided by the auditor. However, the accounting firm does not have an existing requirement under SEC or PCAOB rules to provide information to the audit committee about the auditor's independence, including whether services are being provided to the issuer or any person in a financial reporting oversight role in connection with becoming the issuer's auditors. In other words, before the firm becomes the issuer's auditor. We believe that the accounting firm should discuss with the audit committee before accepting an initial engagement pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB any services that the accounting firm has provided or is providing that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. A requirement to communicate such information would provide the audit committee with information that may be important to its determination about whether to hire the firm as the company's auditor. Accordingly, the board proposed a new independence rule, Rule 3526, Communication with Audit Committees Concerning Independence, that would supersede ISB number 1. In summary, the amendment to Rule 3523 will reduce the likelihood that a company's choice of auditor will be unnecessarily restricted. At the same time, the strengthened responsibility for the auditor to communicate critical information about the auditor's independence to the audit committee in Rule 3526 will help ensure that the audit committee is able to make an informed judgment about whether its new auditor is independent of the company. We received a total of 16 comment letters on proposed Rule 3526 and the proposed amendment to Rule 3523. Almost all of the comments supported the board's proposals, and some recommended various changes. Bella Rivshin, Associate Chief Auditor, will provide some additional information about the new rule, the amendment to Rule 3523, the significant comments we received, and several changes we made as a result of those comments. Before I turn the floor over to Bella, however, I also would like to take a few moments to thank the many people who helped us to complete this project. Those people include Bella Rivshin and Greg Skates from the Office of the Chief Auditor, Jake Lesser and others from the Office of General Counsel, and board members and their staff. I also would like to thank the Securities and Exchange Commission staff for their support and timely advice. Bella?
Thank you, Tom. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. At this time, I would like to highlight significant comments received and the modifications we are recommending to proposed Rule 3523 amendments and proposed Rule 3526. As Tom stated earlier, the proposed amendment to Rule 3523 would exclude the portion of the audit period that precedes the beginning of the professional engagement period. This would be accomplished by striking the words audit and from the current text of Rule 3523. Commenters supported the amendment to Rule 3523 and reiterated their belief that the firm's independence would not be affected by the provision of tax services to a person in the financial reporting oversight role during the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period. Commenters also reaffirmed their belief that if Rule 3523 was not amended, that it could adversely affect the company's ability to change auditors by limiting the company's choice of auditors. The staff agrees that it is appropriate to amend rule, to adopt the amendment to Rule 3523, because it is not necessary to restrict the provision of tax services during the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period to preserve auditor independence. Additionally, although commenters were supportive of the proposed Rule 3523 note, which provides guidance on how to apply Rule 3523 in the context of an initial public offering, commenters recommended expanding the note to include other corporate life events that may result in a need for an audit client's financial statements to be audited pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB for the first time. In light of the comments, the staff is recommending to clarify the note to state that in an initial engagement, for an audit client whose financial statements for the first time will be required to be audited pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB, the provision of tax services to a person covered by Rule 3523 before the earlier of the date that the firm, one, either signs an initial engagement or other agreement to perform an audit pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB, or two, began procedures to do so, does not impair a registered public accounting firm's independence under Rule 3523. Lastly, as part of the proposing relief, the board sought feedback regarding if a transition period was necessary to allow a registered firm to complete covered tax services once the firm was hired as the issuer's auditor, and how long any such transition period should be. The majority of the commenters on this topic recommended that the board provide a 180-day transition period similar to the transition period allowed for a hiring or a promotion of a person into a financial reporting oversight role. Commenters stated that without a transition period, a person in a financial reporting oversight role could experience undue hardship because he or she may have to switch tax preparers in the middle of the personal tax services engagement. After considering these comments, the staff does not believe it is necessary to provide a transition period in situations in which the issuer changes auditors. The board adopted Rule 3523 because the provision of tax services to a person in a financial reporting oversight role after an accounting firm is hired as the auditor creates an unacceptable appearance that the firm lacks independence. While the staff believes that a time-limited exception is warranted to accommodate a person who, through a hiring or a promotion event, abruptly becomes covered by the rule, the staff does not believe that such a transition period is similarly necessary after the auditor change. In the former situation, the firm already is the issuer's auditor and has no control over whether or when the person is promoted or otherwise moved into a financial reporting oversight role. In contrast, the firm controls whether and when it begins a new engagement. The staff therefore believes that the firm is able to conclude or transition to another provider any tax services to a person in a financial reporting oversight role at a new audit client before the engagement. Now I would like to spend a few minutes discussing the proposed Rule 3526, communication with audit committees concerning independence, and that the staff is recommending the board to adopt with one modification. Rule 3526 would require a registered public accounting firm, prior to accepting initial engagement pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB, to describe in writing to the audit committee of the issuer all relationships between the registered public accounting firm or any affiliates of the firm and the potential audit client or persons in financial reporting oversight roles at the potential audit client as of the date of the communication may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. Registered firms would also be required to discuss with the audit committee of the issuer the potential effects of those relationships on independence of the registered public accounting firm, should the firm be appointed the issuer's auditor, and document the substance of the firm's discussion with the audit committee of the issuer. Additionally, registered firms would be required on at least an annual basis after becoming the issuer's auditor to provide the same information to the issuer's audit committee and to affirm to the audit committee in writing that as of the date of the communication, the registered public accounting firm is independent in compliance with PCAOB Rule 3520, Auditor Independence. Proposed Rule 3526 builds on the communication requirements in ISC number 1 and would provide the audit committee with information that may be important to its determination about whether to hire the firm as the company's auditor. The staff believes that Rule 3526, if adopted, will enhance the communication between audit committees and registered firms regarding the firm's independence and will assist in fostering a robust discussion between the firm and the audit committee regarding how a particular relationship might affect the firm's independence. Commenters were generally in favor of the board adopting the proposed rule and stated that the rule would assist audit committees in fulfilling their responsibilities. Most commenters also stated that they believed that the scope of the required communication was appropriate and that some firms were already making the kinds of communications that would be required by proposed Rule 3526. Additionally, while some commenters supported the exclusion of the words in the auditor's professional judgment from Rule 3526, other commenters, however, believe that the absence of the reference to judgment could confuse rather than clarify the requirement and noted that it is reasonable and appropriate for audit committees to rely on the accounting firm's judgment as to what matters should be disclosed. As explained in the proposing release, auditors need to apply judgment to determine whether a relationship may reasonably be thought on to bear on independence. After considering commenters' views, the staff continues to believe that adding a specific reference to the auditor's professional judgment is unnecessary and inappropriate in this instance. While the staff agrees that auditors must exercise sound judgment in carrying out their responsibilities, it does not believe that the specific reference to judgment in this rule is necessary to encourage auditors to do so. Judgment is called for in applying any reasonableness standard to particular facts and circumstances, and Rule 3526 is no different. Determining what relationships may be reasonably thought to bear on independence requires consideration of how a third party, not the auditor, would view the relationship, which is consistent with the SEC general standard of auditor independence in AU Section 220. A reference to in the auditor's professional judgment could suggest otherwise, however, and therefore could discourage the necessary analysis. Accordingly, the staff does not believe it is appropriate to make a reference to the in the auditor's professional judgment in proposed Rule 3526. In the proposing release, the board solicited comment on whether the initial communication in Rule 3526A should be limited to relationships that existed during a particular period, and if so, how long should that period be? The proposed rule was silent on a period of time that auditors would need to consider when determining which relationships may be thought to bear on independence would need to be communicated to the audit committee. Commenters provided a wide variety of recommendations in this area. Some commenters stated that the initial communication should not be limited to relationships that existed during a particular time period, while other commenters recommended that initial communication should be limited to a particular time period ranging from a period covered by the audit and special engagement period to a period covering at least 3 years. After considering these comments, the staff does not believe that the initial communication required by Rule 3526A should be limited to relationships that existed during a particular time period. While the staff agrees that relationships that existed during the audit and professional engagement period may be more likely to bear on independence than in relationships that ended substantially before that time, it does not believe that the passage of time is the only factor relevant to a determination of whether a relationship may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. The nature of the relationship must also be considered. For example, if the firm customized and implemented the company's financial reporting system, that relationship, depending on the circumstances, might be reasonably thought to bear on independence, even if the engagement to design the system was concluded before the beginning of the audit and professional engagement period. Determining whether a particular relationship is covered by Rule 3526A will therefore depend on the relevant facts and circumstances. The staff is recommending one modification to the rule in response to a comment suggesting that Rule 3526 make clear that the relationship required to be disclosed are those that may reasonably be thought to be our independent as of the date of the communication. Because the relevant relationships are those that continue to bear on the independence at the time of the communication, the staff believes that modifying the rule by adding the words as of the date of this communication is appropriate. This clarification should help distinguish relationships that are covered by the rule from those that are not. This modification should also clarify that if a relation may be reasonably thought to bear an independence as of the date of the communication, it must be disclosed regardless of whether it was disclosed in a prior year. Some commenters suggested that auditors should not be required to repeat a previously made disclosure. The staff believes that an earlier disclosure may reduce the amount of information that needs to be disclosed, but it does not obviate the need for disclosure altogether. If the nature of the relationship and the potential effects of the relationship on independence remain substantially unchanged, a reference to the earlier disclosure will generally be sufficient when disclosure is required. Moreover, as discussed above, after some amount of time, the length of which depends on the nature of the relationship, a relationship may no longer be reasonably thought to be on independence and therefore would no longer need to be disclosed. Finally, if proposed Rule 3526 is adopted, it would supersede ISB number 1 and the two related interpretations regarding the application of ISB number 1 to secondary auditors. The treatment of secondary auditors under Rule 3526 will be similar to the treatment of secondary auditors under ISB 1 and the two interpretations. Secondary auditors will not need to comply with Rule 3526, but the primary auditor will need to disclose to the audit committee any relationship of the firm's affiliates that could be reasonably thought to bear on the primary auditor bearing its independence. As under ISB number 1 and related interpretations, the scope of any communication about secondary auditors under Rule 3526 should be clear to the audit committee. Accordingly, the staff expects that the primary auditor's report to either include any covered relationships of any secondary auditors not affiliated with the firm or state that it does not do so. If adopted today, we recommend that Rule 3526 should become effective and ISB number 1 and the two related interpretations superseded on the later of September 30th, 2008, or 30 days after the SEC approves the rule. Rule 3526 would establish new requirements for registered public accounting firms, and therefore the staff believes it is appropriate to allow a reasonable amount of time for such firms to prepare internal policies and procedures and train their employees to ensure compliance with these requirements. We also recommend that Rule 3523 become effective immediately if approved by the SEC. The staff believes that a transition period is not necessary because the amendment to Rule 3523 would have the effect of making permanent the board's delay in implementing the rule as it applies to tax services provided during the period subject to audit but before the professional engagement period begins. Additionally, we recommend the board further adjust the implementation schedule for Rule 3523 in order to allow sufficient time for the SEC to consider the approval of the amendment to Rule 3523. Specifically, we recommend that the board will not apply Rule 3523 to tax services provided on or before December 31st, 2008, when those services are provided during the audit period and are completed before the professional engagement period begins. We recommend that this adjustment to the implementation schedule be effective immediately upon the filing of the SEC with the SEC. In summary, we recommend that the board adopt the proposed amendment to Rule 3523 and proposed Rule 3526. This concludes our presentation today. We'd be pleased to answer your questions at this time.
Thank you, Tom and Bella. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Gelzer.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board adopt the rule on communication with audit committees and the related amendment to the board's interim independence standards and instruct the staff to submit them to the SEC for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I further move that the board adopt the amendment to Rule 3523 as recommended, instruct the staff to submit it to the SEC for approval to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, file the adjustment to the implementation schedule for Rule 3523 with the SEC as an immediately effective proposed rule change.
Second. Is there a second?
Second.
The motion has been made and seconded. So the question before the board is whether to adopt an ethics and independence rule on communication with audit committees and its related amendment to the board's interim independent standards. An amendment to Rule 3523, along with a further adjustment to the implementation schedule for Rule 3523 as presented to us today by staff. Before I ask my fellow board members for their comments, I want to thank Tom Ray, Greg Skates, Bella Rifshin, and others, staff involved, for their hard work in developing the rule and amendment that we're considering today. The board will consider momentarily the staff's recommendation to adopt the new ethics and independence rule to supersede the board's interim independence requirement, independent standard board standard number one, regarding independence discussions with audit committees. As staff has just outlined, the rule under consideration today builds on the communication requirement in ISB 1, which requires, among other things, the firm to annually disclose to the audit committee all relationships between the auditor and its related entities, and the company and its related entities that may reasonably be thought to bear an independence. Rules 3526 will improve ISB 1 by requiring the communications about independence before a firm becomes the issuer's auditor of record, as well as annually thereafter. Comments received on the proposed rule were encouraging and generally supported the rule as an enhancement to auditor communication. Rule 3526 will help audit committees make more informed decisions when hiring their auditors by strengthening and enhancing the communication requirements for auditors regarding their firm's independence. I'm supportive of the modifications that the rule will make to ISB 1 as it will enhance information provided to audit committees that may bear on a firm's independence before they select their auditors. I also believe that real value will be derived from the requirement the accounting firm discuss the potential effects of these relationships on the audit's independence with the audit committee. As staff has already described in detail, the board is asked to consider their recommendation to adopt an amendment to Rule 3523 and to further adjust the implementation schedule for that rule to allow time for implementation. With regard to the amendment to Rule 3523, as Tom has outlined, the board solicited two rounds of comment through both a concept release and the rulemaking proposal on the effects of independence by providing tax services to a person covered by Rule 3523 during the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period, and other practical consequences of applying the rule to that time period. Most comments agreed with the proposal to exclude that period, and many indicated that independence would not be affected by providing services during that period. I support the staff's recommendation. After careful consideration of comments received, it is appropriate to move forward and amend Rule 3523 to exclude the portion of the audit period that precedes the professional engagement period from the scope of the rule. Under the rule as amended, audit firms would continue to be prevented from providing tax services to persons covered by Rule 3523 once the professional engagement period has commenced. In addition, even if a particular tax engagement is not prohibited by Rule 3523, an auditor would still need to consider the relevant facts and circumstances to determine whether it impairs independence under the SEC's general standards. By taking a more targeted approach in this area, I believe the audit committee's choice of auditor will not be unnecessarily restricted. I'll now turn to my fellow board members for any discussion.
So, I support the proposal before the board today. In particular, new Rule 3526 should improve auditor communications with audit committees about independence matters. There's the obvious improvement that we will now require for communication before an auditor is engaged by a company. Perhaps even more importantly, though, I think the new rule does a much better job of articulating the auditor's responsibility to communicate matters that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. To this end, the communication is not limited to disclosures about relationships that are specifically prohibited by the SEC or other applicable rules. Rather, the point of the communication is to apprise the audit committee of other relationships that, although not specifically prohibited, might be perceived by a reasonable investor to impair the auditor's independence. This rule is intended to foster a thoughtful evaluation of whether such relationships could impair the auditor's independence, regardless of whether the relationship is specifically prohibited. No doubt, a lot of work goes into checking for compliance with applicable independence prohibitions. Companies, including their audit committees, are, of course, responsible for making sure their actions comport with applicable law. But that's not the real point of the oversight of the auditor. Rather, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act made audit committees responsible for the appointment, compensation, and oversight of auditors so that they could apply independent judgment about potential conflicts between the auditor and management, including conflicts that are not addressed explicitly in existing prohibitions. First and foremost, the audit committee's job is to protect the interests of the company's investors. The new rule gives them even better tools to do so. I'm also comfortable with the amendment to Rule 3523. By amending the rule, we are not expressly permitting firms to accept audit engagements in situations where they provided tax services to managers during the period subject to audit. Rather, our rule will no longer expressly prohibit firms from accepting such engagements. Nevertheless, as our release explains, each firm is still required to evaluate whether a reasonable investor with knowledge of all the relevant facts and circumstances would view the firm as capable of exercising objective and impartial judgment on all issues encompassed within the audit engagement. And finally, I would also like to thank the staff for putting this proposal together. A lot of thought and effort went into it, including Tom Ray, Bill Rischman, Greg Scape, and also Jake Lesser of the General Counsel's Office. The release accompanying these rules in particular provide a thoughtful discussion of the considerations auditors should undertake. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The recommendations that are before the board today bring us to the end of a long and winding road that began back on December 14, 2004. On that day, the board first proposed a rule to prohibit auditors from providing personal tax services to senior officers who oversee financial reporting at a public company audit client. The idea behind that rule, which has now been largely in effect since mid-2006, remains sound. Auditing a public company and simultaneously assisting its officers with their personal taxes is incompatible with both the fact and appearance of independence. It also carries a potential that the auditor will be caught in the middle if the interests of the audit client and the interests of the officers in minimizing their taxes diverge. Rule 3523 prohibits mixing auditing and executive tax services, and nothing the board is considering today erodes that principle. However, we've also learned a few things during our 3.5-year journey. One is that in framing independence rules, care has to be taken to avoid creating unnecessary obstacles to competition. In its original form, Rule 3523 prevented an audit committee from engaging a new firm to perform the company's audit if that firm had provided tax services for a company financial reporting executive during the early part of the fiscal year to be audited, even though the personal tax work ended before the firm became the financial statement auditor. The amendment to Rule 3523 that we're considering would solve that problem by deleting the reference to audit period from the existing rule. As a result, personal tax services will be required to end when the audit engagement begins, but not before. This change would not compromise the original objective of Rule 3523, and I support it. While we've spent much time and effort on this rather technical issue, resolving it brought to light a second or substantive anomaly in the board's existing rules. The current independence rules, which the board inherited when it adopted the interim standards in 2003, required the auditor to inform the audit committee annually about matters that might bear on the auditor's independence. Surprisingly, however, nothing in those rules says that such a communication should take place before the audit committee decides to hire the auditor. Rule 3526 will address that issue by requiring that, prior to accepting an initial audit engagement, pursuant to PCAOB standards, the would-be auditor must inform the audit committee of any present or past relationships with the public company or with its financial reporting executives that may reasonably be seen as bearing on independence. This seems like common sense. The new rule will make sure that audit committees have the relevant independence information in front of them when they select the auditor, not after they've already made the decision and the work has begun. Rule 3526 is broader than Rule 3523 in that Rule 3526 extends to disclosure about any relationship that might reasonably be seen as bearing on independence. However, the two rules do dovetail. Rule 3526 will assure that audit committees are informed in cases where a potential new audit firm has performed personal tax services for financial reporting executives so that that fact can be weighed in deciding whether to engage the firm. In short, while we've been at this task for a very long time, I think we finally ended up in the right place. The process has resulted in an improvement in both the tax services rule and in the rules governing communications with audit committees about independence matters. I'd like to join in thanking, well, both the commentators who helped us to explore the ramifications of these two proposals, and also those in the Chief Auditor's Office, particularly Bella Ripshin, who's been with this project, I think, since the beginning, or close to it at least, as well as those in our General Counsel's Office who've been working on this long-standing effort. With that, I would like to ask a couple of questions just to bring out some points that have already been touched on. Let's start with Rule 3526, the rule that requires disclosure about matters that could be seen as bearing on independence. I think you alluded to this, Bella, in your comments. A number of the comment letters raised questions about whether there were legal obstacles to making this kind of disclosure to the audit committee, and in particular, whether there were laws or legal principles that stopped the auditor from informing the audit committee if it was doing tax work for an executive. We didn't make any changes in the proposal in response to those comments. And I wonder, first of all, if an auditor, if an accountant prepares a U.S. federal tax return for an individual who's a financial reporting executive at a company, can they disclose that fact to the audit committee?
I'm going to let our general counsel's office answer that question.
I thought you might.
That is correct. As you mentioned, several commenters did raise potential confidentiality issues in various contexts under Rule 3526, including specifically the context of providing tax services to individuals at the audit client. As discussed more fully in the adoption release before the board today, both the Internal Revenue Code and the IRS regulations do prohibit tax return preparers from disclosing or using the taxpayer's tax return information before obtaining a consent from that person to do so. And tax return information is defined quite broadly in those regulations. I should quickly add here that we are not experts on the tax laws, but I do believe that definition is broad enough to include the name of the individual that services that have been provided to and the fact of the engagement itself. So, again, this is an issue that could be overcome with a consent, but is one, as the adopting release for the board today says, that the board staff will be sensitive to and monitor going forward.
And I'm sensitive to your point that we can't interpret the tax laws, and so I don't want to press you to give interpretations that aren't really within our field, but I'll proceed a little farther down this road. Could the auditor say, you mentioned that the name of the client for whom a tax return was prepared would be an issue. Could the auditor say, well, we've done tax work for someone who's a financial reporting executive of this company, but we're not authorized to tell you who it is?
With a consent, they can, of course, disclose the engagement and the details itself. It's not at all clear that without that consent they could do that type of anonymous disclosure. The regulations are quite broad, and in other contexts at least, prohibit tax return preparers from providing even anonymized type information.
Okay, well, let's talk about the consent then. How easier or harder, how formal does that consent have to be? Can the individual simply say, well, sure, I have no problem with you telling the audit committee about your work for me?
Well, again, this is an area where both the IRS regulations and other guidance put out by the IRS are quite specific. There is a requirement that consent be written and have certain specified elements. So that is something trust and expect tax return preparers are familiar with. They would have to follow those applicable IRS requirements and that sort of thing.
It's fun to talk about this. I won't talk about it anymore, except to say it's not a problem really created by this rule. The same issues would arise under ISB number one. Do we have any information about whether this is a problem today or how the firms deal with it today?
We do not, to my knowledge. As you said, this could arise under ISB 1. I don't believe we've come across information that this is an existing problem. This type of issue could also arise in other contexts. As you pointed out in your remarks, our Rule 3523 has been in effect for some time now, and if a firm uncovered a violation of that rule or had an interpretive question related to that rule and needed to disclose these types of details, the firm would have to face similar legal issues in the course of taking those steps. And again, we'll plan to monitor this issue going forward, but we are not aware that it's surfaced as a problem today.
Go ahead. No, please.
I apologize.
Sure.
Thank you. But the individuals that we're talking about are not just any individual off the street. These individuals would be individuals working for that particular company, key officers. And so the situation would be where a key officer would not be granting a consent to the auditor to provide the information to the audit committee of the company.
That's correct.
So it's not as if it's just a consent that I should say someone should be withholding on a regular basis. In fact, I would find it to be very unusual that that would happen, and I'm not sure what happens with the auditor. I can't speculate that far, but I just want to point out, I don't know that this, although it exists and recognize it, I'm not sure, since these are key officers of the company that we're talking about, that this is, it shouldn't necessarily be a big problem, I hope.
Yeah, I said this was an interesting issue. That does provoke another question. Is there anything to stop the audit committee from saying, well, okay, you want to be the CFO of this company? One of the terms of employment is you would have to consent to disclose any relationships you have with the auditor, including whether they prepare your taxes.
Well, I agree with you. That is an interesting question, and I think we've discovered the bounds of my tax law knowledge at this point. That is a question. I do not know whether that would be sufficient under the... Again, the IRS has quite detailed guidance on the consent, and that's a question that doesn't seem to be specifically addressed in that guidance, and I would leave to my colleagues in the tax line.
Okay, thank you. And Bella, you've talked in some detail about this, leading the words in the auditor's judgment from the description of the matters that have to be disclosed that might bear on independence. I'm just sort of a summary question there. Does the staff see the inclusion or deletion of those words as having any impact on what's actually disclosed? Does it expand or contract the scope of the requirements?
Well, I might add a different voice to that question. You indicated Bill did touch on that question, and I'd like to speak to it for a moment. Excluding those words, in our view, should help auditors more clearly focus on those relationships that the audit committee should be aware of. I think, as Bella did indicate, the existing independence rules are written in the context of what is important to a reasonable person, to a reasonable investor. So accordingly, the auditor's judgment, and the judgment by the auditor is necessary in this case. The auditor's judgment about what may reasonably be thought to bear on independence must be made in that context. So we believe that omitting that reference to the auditor's professional judgment would clarify the requirement by essentially reminding auditors of the need to focus on the perceptions of reasonable third parties when making those independence determinations, when making those judgments about what should be communicated.
Okay, I agree with what you said, although it's a little different than the answer that I expected. I think you're saying then that perhaps in a subtle way it expands the scope of the requirement because it does require the auditor to focus on what a reasonable third person might think rather than just on what he or she himself might.
Well, in my own view, I don't think it really does have a substantive change because of the fact that the existing independence requirements, one of which is embedded in the auditing standards, does speak to a reasonable third party already. So the auditor's judgment has to be made in that context.
It does, this is a little more simplistic, but it does seem to me that if we put in the standards in the auditor's judgment, everywhere where a judgment is required in the course of auditing, the standards would double in length. So I personally didn't see this as a substantive change in the disclosure requirement. Bill, you also touched on this issue of secondary auditors. Mm-hmm. And hey, first of all, just to keep us on the same page, what do you mean by a secondary auditor?
A secondary auditor would be someone that would assist the primary auditor in performing audit procedures for a financial statement audit. And you could have someone, a secondary auditor, that is affiliated with the primary auditor part of a network or the relationship the primary auditor has. Or you could have a secondary auditor that is not affiliated with the primary auditor, that the primary auditor hires to assist them in the audit engagement.
And this is often, although not always, these folks are going to be foreign firms. If we're talking about a U.S. auditor, they're often going to be firms located outside the United States that are involved in some way.
You potentially could have, if you have a global company that has operations outside the U.S., the primary auditor in the U.S. may hire a secondary auditor in that foreign jurisdiction to assist them in performing certain audit procedures.
So what's the bottom line? How is the audit committee going to find out whether these secondary firms have any relationships that might bear on their independence? I assume they do have to be independent on the same terms that the primary auditor.
They do have to be independent. And if the secondary auditor is affiliated with the primary auditor has a responsibility to disclose any of those relationships that may be reasonably thought to bear on independence under Rule 3526. Which is similar to how ISB-1 would treat it. Also, as it relates to a secondary auditor that is not affiliated with the primary auditor, we would expect that the primary auditor would explicitly either include those relationships in the communication or explicitly state that it does not do so. So the audit committee would be aware in either case as to the situation.
So the secondary firm ought to be making its own communication to the audit committee.
The secondary auditor is not required to comply with Rule 3526. Only the primary auditor is required to comply with Rule 3526.
So I guess it'd be a good thing for audit committees to ask for on their own, then, if it's not explicitly covered in the rules, at least if they're concerned about the independence. I guess that they should be an unaffiliated secondary firm. Let me turn to Rule 3523. I think you touched on the comments that we got where people expressed concern about the situation where a company is a private company, it has an existing auditor, it decides to make an IPO, to become a public company. So the question then arises, well, at what point do we have to stop doing tax services or financial reporting executives of the company? And we have a note to Rule 3523 that answers that question by saying the earlier of when you sign the engagement letter or when you begin the procedures to do an audit pursuant to PCAOB standards. Am I on track so far? I guess it would be fairly understandable when you sign an engagement letter. If you're the ongoing auditor, is it going to be clear, what procedures you have to do in order to transform your existing audits into PCAOB audits? Or in this context, I guess the question is that going to be a clear line of demarcation so that people will know when they have to cut off these tax services for reporting executives?
Well, we recognize that in certain circumstances it might be difficult to identify the when the continuing auditor began the procedures pursuant to the standards of the CCOB. In the staff's view, the auditor begins the procedures for the purposes of Rule 3523 when the auditor begins procedures, including the required audit planning procedures, to update its earlier audits to conform them to the standards of the PCOB, or begins procedures on a new audit pursuant to those standards. This point in time will depend on the particular facts and circumstances of the particular engagement and the corporate life events, rather than any specific triggering event that I think could be established by the board in the rule. So the auditor will need to be cognizant of basically their relationship with the client and the communications that they are having with the client regarding the client going pursuing this initial public offering to determine when they start performing those procedures and when they would need to stop performing the tax services.
I guess you said that the planning would be the triggering point, or once they begin concrete planning for the future.
Yeah.
Just one other thing about something else that people were quite concerned about in the comments were mergers and whether we should have some kind of transition period or guidance about how Rule 3523 impacts the merger situation. And I guess what they're thinking about are two situations. I mean, if A and B merge, and the auditor of A is the auditor of the survivor, when do they have to stop doing any tax work they might be doing for the financial executives of B? And I guess you could have the reverse situation, where the auditor of B becomes the auditor of the surviving company and would have to stop doing tax services for the executives of A. And we could just briefly address how the rule applies to those situations. Again, we haven't made any changes to address those.
Yes, we have not made any changes. In a business combination that results in a change of employer for a person in financial reporting oversight role, for example, from an acquired company to a surviving company, the existing transition period in Rule 3523C would apply. So in your first example, because the individuals that are working for the acquired company, Company B, they would experience an other change of employment event if they became employees of Company A, the surviving company, as a result of the acquisition. If these executives were actually had an engagement for personal tax services in process before the acquisition took place, then the firm would have 180 days allowed under our rule, current Rule 3523C, to complete the tax services for those individuals or transition them to the provider. As a reminder, Rule 3523C provides this 180-day limited transition period to conclude the tax services to a person who was not in a financial reporting oversight role before hiring, promotion, or other change in employment events. And in your example, the first example is that because they go from an acquiring company to a surviving company in terms of employers, that would be considered another change of employment event. And we actually provide a little bit more explanation of this in the questions and answers that the staff issued in April of 2007. Now, talking about your...
So that's just on the situation you just covered, the people at B, it's just as if they just got promoted to become financial reporting executives or were hired.
Yeah.
They got the
because they changed employers, they would be allowed, the auditors would be allowed to have 180 days to complete their tax services that were in process at the time. Now, as it relates to your second example, let's say, same situation, but it's the acquirer company's auditor, Company B's auditor, is the one that becomes Company A auditor. Well, in that situation, you would assume that Company B's auditor was providing tax services to Company A because they, for those individuals who are not in financial reporting oversight roles. In that situation, because the individuals in a financial reporting oversight role were employed by Company A before acquiring Company B and stayed employed by Company A after the acquisition, Rule 3523 would not apply. And therefore, the Company B's auditor, although the surviving auditor, would not have a 180-day transition period to complete those tax services. We believe this is appropriate because, as discussed earlier in our remarks, the staff does not believe a transition period is necessary to allow a newly engaged auditor to conclude the in-process tax services to persons in a financial reporting oversight role at what would be a change of auditor, so therefore a new audit client. We would hope that because an acquisition or another business combination does not occur overnight, that there would be enough time during that, I guess, that business transaction to complete those services before the Company B's auditor officially becomes Company A, the surviving company's auditor.
Okay, just one last thing. Maybe it's just me, but it does seem to me that there's some ability to trip over Rule 3523. What do you do if you think you violated the rule? You come to us? Come to the SEC? We have the ability to grant waivers? Do they have the ability to grant waivers? And what happens if you screw up under this rule?
Well, I'm going to let our general counsel's office answer that question.
Try that one as well. And before Spivak responded as well, too, I should point out the board's action today will have the effect of narrowing the scope of Rule 3523, which hopefully should minimize the number of inadvertent violations that do occur under that rule or situations in which some sort of exemption would be thought to be necessary. That said, if a firm has violated a rule or thinks it needs an exemption, the firm would need to think about its alternatives and its responsibilities in that situation, including its responsibilities to its audit client. While we do have authority under Title II of the Act to grant exemptions on a case-by-case basis and subject to SEC review, it's important to remember that both the SEC and the PCAOB implement independence rules, including specifically enforcing PCAOB independence rules such as Rule 3523. And the SEC has a dual interest in these matters because in addition to overseeing auditors, they have responsibility for public companies' filings, and public companies, of course, have an obligation to have their financial statements audited by an independent accountant. Therefore, in practice, when firms do become aware of violations, including a violation of a PCAOB independence rule, it's often the case that they will approach the SEC's Office of Chief Accounting Staff, perhaps in conjunction with the PCAOB staff, about the issue. I can't speak for the SEC specifically about when or under what conditions they would choose not to enforce a violation, but again, by ensuring that both the PCAOB and SEC staff are aware of the issue and involved in the discussion, at least the firm has taken the necessary steps to see that a coordinated resolution of the issue is possible.
Thank you very much.
Any further discussion? If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. If there's no further business, this concludes our agenda today. The meeting is now adjourned. We will rise in the open meeting and reconvene at 10:35 for the closed meeting of the board. Thank you, and thanks again to Tom, Bella, Greg, and Jake.